Throughout their rich and storied history, the United States' Federal Bureau of Investigation has examined a multitude of frightening and unsettling crimes. But in the mid-1970s, the FBI was tasked with investigating a series of violent incidents that had captured the attention of the American public. It was a story of alleged brainwashing, militant politics, and innocence lost. It raised questions that have remained unanswered even all these years later. This is the story of Patty Hearst. Patricia Campbell Hearst was born in San Francisco on February 20th of 1954 and was a granddaughter of billionaire media mogul William Randolph Hearst. At the time of his passing in 1951, William Hearst's assets were valued at the modern equivalent of $330 billion. William's vast wealth made his family one of the richest in the world, and with money came fame. By the mid-70s, the Hearsts were a household name throughout the state of California, synonymous with old money, excess, and the trappings of capitalism. Some found their story to be inspirational, regarding Hearst as the personification of the American dream. But their billions also made them a target for those with sinister intentions. On February 4th of 1974, Patty was a 19-year-old college sophomore living with her fiancé in an apartment on Berkeley's Bienvenue Street. She tended not to flaunt her family's name or status among her social circle, but regardless, once one or two of her neighbors figured out exactly who she was, people began to talk. It was hot gossip that a member of the esteemed Hearst family was living in a hippie hole like Berkeley, but for the most part, the neighborhood greeted the news with either curiosity or indifference. There was no perceived threat to Patty's safety, and unlike some other members of the family, Patty did not have a bodyguard or any other kind of personal security. When this came to the attention of certain malevolent and delusional individuals, a plan was hatched, one which led to a group of armed thugs invading Patty's apartment at around 9 p.m. on the evening of February 4th. They began viciously assaulting Patty's fiancé, with one of their number choking her unconscious before she was thrown in the trunk of her kidnapper's car. Then, once their target was secure, the kidnappers simply took off in their vehicles, with Patty as their prisoner. The next time the trunk was opened, Patty had regained consciousness, and she was told that she'd be shot dead if she screamed or attempted to escape. Her captors then gagged her, blindfolded her, and carried her from the trunk into a makeshift cell somewhere far from prying eyes. After a brief period of captivity, Patty's kidnappers explained that she was now a hostage and that their ransom demands would be announced shortly. But unlike any other criminal organization, whose members would rather mask their identities, Patty's kidnappers were only too happy to explain that she had been taken prisoner by the Symbionese Liberation Army. There's a good chance that Patty had already heard of the so-called United Federated Forces of the Symbionese Liberation Army, and at the very least, she will have been familiar with the cold-blooded murder they meted out. Just a few months before her kidnapping, Patty might have heard the news that Oakland's superintendent of public schools had been gunned down in public, with the assassin using cyanide-tipped bullets to guarantee the death of their target. This had been the work of the SLA, who explained to Patty that the Marcus Foster's murder had been part of a wider campaign to promote feminist, anti-racist, and anti-capitalist ideals. What's more, Patty's kidnap was intended to leverage her family's political influence in order to free the SLA members who had been arrested for Foster's murder. Shortly after the SLA announced their list of demands, the state of California let it be known that under no circumstances would either of the SLA murder suspects be released. When the state made it clear that they wouldn't budge on the matter, the SLA released a new list of demands, swapping out the prisoner exchange for a call for the Hearst family to use $400 million of their fortune to end food poverty in California. In response, the Hearst family announced the creation of the $2 million relief fund called People in Need. The organization would set about feeding needy families in the Bay Area for a year, but once it was set up, Patty's kidnappers refused to release her, arguing that a paltry $2 million was just a fraction of their original demand. Yet as the Hearst family continued to negotiate for Patty's release, the Symbionese Liberation Army began a new phase of Patty's detainment, systematic brainwashing. Patty later said that for the first week of her capture, she was kept bound and blindfolded in a small, dark closet. She claims she was assaulted, tortured, and berated almost nonstop, and that at one point, her captors subjected her to a mock execution. Once her spirit was sufficiently broken, the SLA began to let Patty out of her makeshift prison cell in order to join their political discussions. If she showed an interest in their meetings and participated in discussions, she was given more food than her usual allowance, incentivizing her to educate herself on the subjects of their conversations. Around the same time, she was given several pieces of literature, including the SLA's manifesto and a small reading light, so she could continue her so-called political awakening from the confines of her cell. After months of routine brainwashing techniques, Patty claimed that the SLA leadership presented her with an ultimatum. She was told that negotiations for her release had completely failed and that she had outlived her use to the organization. According to the SLA founder, Donald DeFries, this left the group with no choice but to execute her. However, there was one thing Patty could do to save her own life, and that was to enlist in the ranks of the SLA and pledge her undying loyalty to them. DeFries told me that the War Council was thinking about killing me unless I was with them, and that I better start thinking about that as a possibility, Patty later said. After that, I simply accommodated my thoughts to coincide with theirs. After Patty swore an oath to fight and die with her new comrades, her blindfold was finally taken off, and she greeted her former jailers for the first time. The mood was decidedly different, to say the least, and as those that had once tortured her now embraced her as family, Patty Hearst's brainwashing was complete. From then on, she was treated just like any other member of the group, and although she later claimed to have been acting out of a will to survive, Patty certainly played the part of the enthusiastic young revolutionary. She attended political education sessions, mastered a number of different firearms, and according to some ex-SLA members, partook in a number of the group's free love events. She also consented to record a piece of audio that the SLA planned on releasing to the public, and in it, Patty announced that she had changed her name to Tanya, and that she was now a full-time urban guerrilla. When the tape was released, it caused a wave of intense interest from local and national media, and it wasn't long before the FBI was called in to investigate. Then, on April 15th of 1974, just over 2 months after she first disappeared, a San Francisco branch of the Hibernia Bank became the target of an SLA robbery. The nation was stunned when a pale and gaunt Patty Hearst was recorded on the bank's surveillance cameras. According to one witness, she was wielding an assault rifle, and upon entering the bank, she shouted, "I'm Tanya, up against the wall, now." The robbery ended up going horribly wrong when two bank customers, ignorant of the situation inside, walked into the bank to be greeted by a hail of bullets. The bloodshed prompted a premature end to the robbery as the SLA members rushed to a nearby getaway car, and that's when something curious happened. According to the bank's surveillance camera footage, Patty Hearst was the last member of the stick-up crew to reach the getaway car and seems to hesitate in a few frames of the recording. It then becomes apparent that one or two SLA members are pointing their weapons at her as if threatening to shoot her unless she gets into the van. Some have argued that Patty may have been using this moment to consider an escape, while others state that the guns weren't aimed at her, but rather at the bank's doors should they be required to cover their retreat. Either way, the incident transformed Patty's public image from a former kidnap victim into a wanted criminal, and a judge approved a warrant for her arrest. Just over a month later, the manager of a Mel's Sporting Goods in Inglewood observed a minor theft occurring in one of his stores. When the manager attempted to apprehend the suspected thief as he walked towards his van, a heavily armed Patty Hearst leapt from the vehicle and began firing a high-caliber rifle right into the air. This caused the manager to run for cover as the shoplifter hurled himself into the van's side door. Knowing that the police would be actively searching for them, Patty Hearst and her shoplifter comrade hijacked two different cars while holding each of the former drivers as hostages. They hoped to once again use the hostages as leverage for their own release, but it was too late, as just hours later, the LAPD had surrounded the SLA's Los Angeles headquarters with the intention of bringing the group down once and for all. During the ensuing firefight, six SLA members were shot and killed by police officers, while the group's leader took their own life in preference to being taken alive. The murder of her comrade seemed to radicalize Patty even further, and in the aftermath of their funerals, she poured herself into the construction of improvised bombs, two of which were used in failed attempts to kill police officers in August of 1975. Yet Patty's foray into bomb-making would be her undoing, and evidence recovered from the two explosive devices led to her arrest in a San Francisco apartment on September 18th of 1975. As she was booked into jail, Patty supposedly listed her occupation as urban guerrilla and asked her attorney to relay the following message to the general public. "Tell everybody that I'm smiling," she said, "that I feel free and strong, and I send my greetings and love to all the sisters and brothers out there." When Patty was arrested, she was barely recognizable to the sweet young lady who had been kidnapped a year and a half earlier. She weighed a stick-thin 87 pounds, and a psychologist noticed signs of severe mental impairment, later describing her as a low-IQ zombie. Patty couldn't seem to remember large tracts of her life before joining the SLA, and confessed to being plagued by horrifying nightmares which reflected her time in captivity. At her trial for the Hibernia bank robbery, an unsympathetic judge dismissed any claim of brainwashing and ruled that Patty's taped and written statements were made on a completely voluntary basis. According to him, since she wasn't deemed to be suffering from any kind of recognizable mental illness, she was fit to stand trial. The judge also paid particular attention to a jailhouse recording of a visiting day conversation between Patty and a friend of hers, in which she used to speak of how her radical beliefs remained steadfast in the face of a lengthy prison sentence. Dr. Harry Kozel described Hearst as a rebel in search of a cause, and her participation in the Hibernia robbery had been an act of free will. Another psychologist was asked if Patty was in fear of death or great bodily injury during the robbery, to which she gave the resounding answer of no. Patty's own defense hinged on her claim that she had been suffering from the now famous Stockholm Syndrome. Her attorneys argued that her SLA captors had demanded she appear enthusiastic during the robbery and warned she would pay with her life for any mistake, while in reference to the sporting goods robbery, Patty claimed that, "When it happened, I didn't even think. I just did it. And if I had not done it, and if they had been able to get away, they would have killed me." With regards to the public statements she made, Patty claimed that she had been writing the SLA version of events and had been punched in the face by one of her captors when she refused to be more militant in her words and actions. She also claimed to have been repeatedly violated by her captors for even the smallest of infractions. When news of these allegations reached the surviving SLA members, they were outraged and claimed that Patty had been in a romantic relationship with one of the men she'd accused. It was even alleged that Patty had been given a stone trinket by the man and had been so close to him that she kept the carving with her in her jail cell. This trinket was later paraded before the jury, who saw it as powerful evidence of Patty's deception, despite claims she believed it was a pre-Columbian artifact of archaeological significance. Despite appeals for mercy, Patty was convicted of the bank robbery on March 20th of 1976 and was handed the maximum sentence of 35 years imprisonment. However, this was later reduced to 7 years after another judge declared the original sentence to be overly harsh. Almost immediately after her arrival in prison, Patty had to undergo emergency surgery after suffering a collapsed lung. But curiously, the same condition prevented her from appearing at the trials of two of her former SLA comrades. Then, after she finally agreed to testify, The prison took no special security measures for her safety until she found a dead rat on her bunk on the day of an SLA member's hearing. Patty's brainwashing defense was revisited years later, after Representative Leo Ryan was murdered while visiting the Jonestown settlement in Guyana. By happenstance, he'd been collecting signatures on a petition for Patty's release in the weeks before his murder, and the incident garnered the attention of none other than legendary actor John Wayne. Wayne pointed out the contradiction in the public accepting that Jim Jones had brainwashed 900 individuals into taking their own life en masse, but refusing to believe that the SLA could have brainwashed a young and impressionable teenager. The actor's plea touched the hearts of many who were skeptical of Patty's brainwashing claims, and it prompted President Jimmy Carter to secure her release from prison 8 months before she was eligible for her first parole hearing. Patty later recovered full civil rights when President Bill Clinton granted her a pardon on his last day in office. It's almost impossible to determine the exact truth of Patty Hearst's kidnapping, and if she really believed in the Symbionese Liberation Army's core ethics. But if it's true, if she really was brainwashed by her captives, the implications are terrifying. There's no doubt that Patty came from an especially privileged background, but by all accounts, she was still just a regular teenage girl. But once she was a prisoner of a group of deranged radicals, all it took was a few days of starvation and torture, and that regular teenage girl was gone. On November 1st of 1955, United Airlines Flight 629 took off from Stapleton Airport in Denver, Colorado at 6:52 p.m. It had been bound for Portland, Oregon, but the doomed flight would never arrive, as just 11 minutes after takeoff, all 39 passengers and 5 crew members were instantly killed when their plane crashed on a sugar beet farm near Longmont, Colorado. As news of the tragedy spread like wildfire across the nation, the FBI volunteered itself to undertake any upcoming investigation into the crash. The following day, while the victims' bodies were still being identified, an FBI scientist was sent to the scene to conduct an examination of the wreckage. He discovered that the tail section of the plane had been cleanly severed from the rest of it, so cleanly it was as if it had been cut with a knife, and that it had fallen with only minor damage approximately 1.5 miles from the main crash site. The scientists also ruled out the possibility of an explosion due to malfunction, and noted that the plane seemed to have been in perfect working condition when it took off on its final flight. Less than a week later, the Civil Aeronautics Board Chief of Investigations officially stated that there were indications of sabotage and invited the FBI to open up a criminal investigation into the 44 murders which took place that day. The very next day, the FBI ordered at least a dozen of its agents to work on the case full-time, and over the weeks that followed, 4 teams of interviewers questioned almost 24 different people in order to gather witness testimonies. Witnesses claimed that the initial explosion had occurred while the plane was operating in a routine manner, and that it appeared to have been of tremendous force, causing fiery streamers to fall from the plane. A second explosion, probable of one or more fuel tanks, had occurred when the engines and forward compartment of the plane struck the ground. The scientists ordered that the investigative team recover as many pieces of the wreckage as they could, and bit by bit, the plane was then reassembled in a kind of giant jigsaw puzzle at a nearby warehouse. And this served 2 purposes. Firstly, reassembling the wreckage would allow investigators to identify the exact location of the explosion that caused the crash. But the process would also allow investigators to identify and isolate any foreign materials that may have constituted an explosive device. Before the wreckage was even fully assembled, investigators were able to determine that the explosion had occurred in the plane's 4th cargo pit, meaning that the detonation had originated in a piece of luggage loaded onto the plane at Denver Airport. As the analysis of the plane's wreckage continued, investigators discovered 5 small fragments of sheet metal were found which could not in any way be identified with parts of the plane or known contents of the cargo. These fragments were coated with a kind of gray soot associated with an explosion, and one of them was determined to have come from a type of 6-volt battery, the kind one might use to power a remote detonator. It became evident that a downing of Flight 629 was no tragic accident. It was a devastating, deliberate act of murder involving the smuggling of a bomb onto the plane. As the investigation progressed, FBI agents began to profile the lives of each innocent victim. They interviewed hundreds of their family members, friends, and employers, hoping to identify any potential motive for homicide. Agents also set about poring over the remains of the victim's luggage and personal effects. It was during this process that something intriguing came to light. On board the doomed aircraft that day was a woman by the name of Daisy E. King, and after recovering and collating a series of personal letters, newspaper clippings, an address list, and 2 keys for safety deposit boxes, investigators were able to put together a detailed picture of her life and family. One of the newspaper clippings revealed that her son, Jack Gilbert Graham, was wanted on charges of forgery dating back to 1951. This might not have been all that alarming on its own, but the petty financial crime became all the more interesting once agents conducted another piece of analysis. A large effort was made to identify victims who'd had large travel life insurance policies taken out in their name prior to the fatal flight. This is how agents discovered that Daisy E. King had no less than 3 large policies in her name, something they found highly suspicious considering most other passengers had no more than 2. When such compelling evidence was presented to a federal judge, a search warrant was quickly drawn up to authorize the search of Jack Gilbert Graham's home. During the search, police officers recovered the paperwork for a $40,000 travel insurance policy that Jack had taken out on his mother in the months before she died. It was also discovered that Jack had recently hired an attorney to rewrite his mother's life insurance policy, naming himself the recipient of the vast majority of his mother's estate. After interviewing friends and family members, FBI agents learned that Jack and his mother had an extremely fraught relationship, and during his teenage years, Jack often found himself homeless after a particularly violent argument occurred. Agents also learned that Jack and his mother had reunited later in life to operate their own drive-in restaurant, but that the venture had almost failed on account of their volatile relationship. One former friend of Daisy's mentioned that Jack had apparently caused a small explosion at the restaurant after one altercation, and that he had repeatedly been caught pilfering money from the registers. After the FBI began delving into Jack Gilbert Graham's history, agents discovered a number of pertinent and disturbing details. An associate of Graham's mentioned how he'd once performed demolition work in the U.S. Navy and that Graham had once purchased a brand new truck, took out an insurance policy on it, then wrecked it under suspicious circumstances almost immediately afterward. FBI agents also discovered the details of Graham's forgeries, learning he'd committed the crimes while employed as a payroll clerk for a factory in Denver. Graham had stolen a number of blank checks, forged the name of the company owner, then cashed the checks for approximately $4,200 in cash. Graham was convicted of the forgeries on November 3rd of 1951, but the sentence was suspended, and he had been placed on probation for a period of 5 years. Graham might have dodged a spell in prison, but the financial restitution broke his proverbial bank, and there's no doubt that this left him a very desperate man. FBI agents first interviewed Graham just over a week after the bombing, with a particular interest paid to the small explosion that had occurred at his mother's restaurant. Graham stated that the explosion was caused by someone disconnecting a gas line, and describing how the gas had filled the room until it reached a pilot light on a water heater, igniting the gas and causing the explosion. He had vehemently denied that he might have been involved in the explosion, and due to the interview taking place on a purely voluntary basis, investigators were forced to pursue a different line of questioning so not to rile Graham up too much. Questions then turned to the contents of his mother's luggage, and although Graham denied knowing what she'd packed, he seemed to suggest that she may have been in possession of a large amount of shotgun shells and rifle ammunition, and that she intended to use them to hunt caribou in Alaska. The fact that Graham seemed to know that an explosion had occurred, and that he also seemed to know how it occurred, was something investigators found deeply suspicious. and after Graham's wife was questioned, the evidence against him became considerably more damning. Gloria Graham shared 2 children with Jack and confirmed that his mother had been living with them in the time before her death. She also mentioned that on the day she died, Jack had given his mother a present, a box believed to contain a small set of tools for forming seashells into art objects. Gloria recalled that this package was the size of a large shoebox and wrapped up in decorative paper, and that Jack insisted on packing the gift into her suitcase as a surprise. Gloria also mentioned that after dropping his mother off at the airport, Jack had been pale and nauseous. She asked him if everything was okay, but her husband brushed her concerns off by telling her that he'd eaten some bad food. Then, after receiving news of his mother's death, Jack didn't seem like he was grieving properly. In fact, he seemed vexed by something. He was barely eating or sleeping, and he spent most of his time walking up and down both inside and outside their home. Jack Graham's half-sister also had a lot to say about him, telling FBI agents that he had a warped, morbid sense of humor, and had actually witnessed Jack assaulting his wife. She also confirmed that, although she'd never seen any evidence of it, her half-brother had boasted of his experience in manufacturing explosives. On November 12th of 1955, the FBI invited Jack and Gloria down to their offices under the pretense of their assistance being required. The next day, they voluntarily appeared at the Denver FBI office, where they were shown fragments of Daisy's luggage. The couple were as helpful as can be, and were treated as nicely as possible by the attending agents, but at the conclusion of the appointment, the agents told Jack that they wished to interview him further concerning several aspects of the case. A particular interest to the agents was Jack's suggestion that a box of ammunition might be to blame for the explosion, and their follow-up questions concerned the gift Jack had given his mother on the day of the plane crash. Jack then contradicted his wife's previous statement, and told the FBI that he had not given her a set of crafting tools on the day of her departure. At first, Jack was indignant in the face of the FBI's insinuations, but once again grew pale when the agents asked him what he had done with his mother upon driving her to the airport. When the agents produced a copy of a travel insurance policy that Jack's mother had bought prior to her flight, he had no choice but to admit that he'd made himself the sole beneficiary. Shortly after the interview, Graham was informed that he was a suspect in the case. He refused to submit to a polygraph test, but gave the FBI his consent to search his home, automobiles, and property. During the search of Graham's home, a small roll of copper wire with yellow insulation was located in a shirt pocket of some work clothes. Experts agreed that the wire appeared to be the type used in detonating primer caps. When confronted with the evidence of his bomb-making, Jack broke under the pressure and admitted planning the explosive device, killing 43 people in order to ensure his mother's death. He went on to describe how he'd used a time bomb composed of 25 sticks of dynamite, 2 electric primer caps, a timer, and a 6-volt battery. Jack Graham had already admitted his guilt, but at his first court hearing on December 9th of 1955, he claimed he was innocent by reason of insanity before, during, and after the alleged commission of the crime. Graham was then examined by doctors at the Colorado Psychopathic Hospital, and during an interview with one of the doctors, he claimed that he'd concocted his entire confession. He claimed that he'd gotten the idea from a photograph he'd seen in an FBI agent's office, one which depicted the apprehension of the Nazi saboteurs who had landed on the Florida coast during World War II. In the background of the picture, a trio of FBI agents are digging up a cache of dynamite that had been buried on a beach, and Jack claimed that his fractured mind had latched onto the idea of explosives. Despite his assertions of being mentally unwell, Graham was found legally sane by all 4 psychiatrists, and he was taken back to the Denver County Jail. For almost 2 months, Graham was a model prisoner, and his jail time was mostly spent quietly reading or chatting with the guards. But just after 5:30 p.m. on February 10th of 1956, the sheriff's deputy, tasked with keeping an eye on Graham's cell block, heard an unusual sound coming from one of the cells. After further examination, The deputy determined the sound was coming from Jack Graham's cell, and when he opened the door, he found that Graham had tried to strangle himself with a pair of socks. The deputy quickly untied the makeshift garrote, saving Graham's life before he was transported to the prison's hospital. Once Graham regained consciousness, he was placed in a straitjacket, then taken to the psychiatric ward of Colorado General Hospital, where he was strapped to a bed with four guards posted nearby. Then, as the days went by, Graham stunned psychiatrists by talking freely and honestly about his involvement in the bombing. He admitted that the whole scheme had been a plot to kill his mother, and that he didn't feel an ounce of remorse for taking almost 50 other people with her. I realized that there were about 50 or 60 people carried on that kind of plane, but the number of people to be killed made no difference to me. It could have been 1,000, he said. When their time comes, there's nothing they can do about it. On February 24th of 1956, Graham finally dropped the insanity plea and was returned again to Denver County Jail. His April 16th trial set an all-time record for the state of Colorado in the number of jurors examined. In all, 231 were called, and the final jury represented a cross-section of American life. It included two housewives, one a former beauty queen, two typists, a movie executive, an engineer, a truck driver, a sales lady, a telephone man, a lithographer, a bookkeeper, and a salesman. On the first day and almost throughout the trial, hundreds of people waited for hours in the halls outside the courtroom, hoping for a chance to get seats. They brought their lunches, afraid to leave the room for fear of losing their places. The guard at the door, however, saved a seat for one woman who arrived promptly at 9 a.m. each morning. She was an attractive, young-looking woman who just so happened to be the wife of the United Airlines pilot of the ill-fated flight, who sat only a few feet from Graham throughout the trial. The accused remained calm as the trial progressed, and although Graham had lost weight since his arrest, he still looked relatively healthy. He slouched in his chair, chewed gum, and even joked with his legal team, all while a district attorney described him as a straight-up monster, someone who had taken the lives of almost 50 people, including his own mother, coldly, carefully, and deliberately. Finally, on May 5th of 1956, the jury took just an hour to find Jack Gilbert Graham guilty of murder in the first degree, with a recommendation that he receive the penalty of death. The judge then sentenced him to be put to death in late August of 1956, and after a brief stay at the Colorado State Penitentiary, Graham was executed in the gas chamber at 8 p.m. on Friday, January 11th of 1957. The bombing of Flight 629 is arguably one of the worst single acts of mass murder in American history, but it isn't the death toll that makes it one of the most infamous. It's that a man wanted to get away with the murder of his own mother, so much that he thought nothing of killing 43 other people in the process. Click the join button to become a member today for exclusive content. Just before 11 a.m. in Kansas City on September 28th of 1953, a nun working at a school for small children was confronted at the school's front entrance by a woman claiming to be the aunt of a child named Bobby Greenlease. 6-year-old Bobby was the son of Robert Greenlease Sr., a wealthy businessman who lived in the affluent Kansas City suburb of Mission Hills. The woman, claiming to be Bobby's aunt, was visibly upset when she told the nun that Bobby's mother had been rushed to the hospital after suffering a heart attack. The nun later recalled that, when she'd fetched Bobby, he walked directly to the woman without hesitation, and there was no reason to doubt that the woman was his aunt. The woman then took Bobby by the hand, then led him towards a waiting taxi. About a half hour later, a different nun called the Greenlease family to express the school's condolences to them. The voice on the other end sounded surprised. Mrs. Greenlease hadn't suffered a heart attack, and there was no way his aunt could have collected him from school. Despair set in once both parties realized that Bobby had been kidnapped, and after the Kansas City Chief of Police begged the governor for as much assistance as possible, the FBI was called in to investigate. One of the first witnesses questioned by federal agents was a Kansas City cab driver named Willard Pearson Creech. Willard told the agents that on the morning of the kidnapping, a woman fitting the description of Bobby's kidnapper climbed into his cab, then asked him to drive her to the Katz drugstore at Westport and Main Street in Kansas City. After waiting approximately 6 minutes, the cab driver watched as the woman re-entered the cab accompanied by a small boy who looked just like little Bobby. A few hours after the kidnapping, the Greenleases received the first ransom letter, which demanded $600,000 in exchange for the boy's release. The letter also stated that if the money was handed over within 24 hours and there was no funny business, Bobby would be returned safe and sound. A second ransom letter was delivered the following day and contained Bobby's Jerusalem medal to prove the kidnappers were serious. The letter assured them that Bobby was homesick but otherwise okay, and reiterated the kidnappers' demands for $600,000. The final communication between the Greenleases and the kidnappers was a telephone call received after the cash had been delivered at around 1 a.m. on October 5th. The kidnappers confirmed that they had received the $600,000 in cash and assured the family that Bobby was alive and that he would be returned to them over the next 24 hours. Yet unbeknownst to the Greenlease family, the kidnappers had murdered Bobby not long after the abduction and had buried the body in St. Joseph, Missouri, before escaping to St. Louis with the ransom money. Just over a week later, the St. Louis Police Department received a call from a man named John Oliver Hager, who was a driver for the Ace Cab Company in St. Louis. John mentioned that a woman fitting the description of Bobby's kidnapper had been spotted on Arsenal Street in St. Louis and relayed the description of her male companion to law enforcement. The information John provided quickly led to the arrest of one Carl Austin Hall on the evening of October 6, 1953. Later that night, after a huge amount of pressure from the FBI, Carl Hall led a team of agents to an apartment on Arsenal Street in St. Louis, where his girlfriend, Bonnie Emily Hetty, was taken into custody. Both Hall and Hetty were interrogated by FBI agents, and after admitting that they'd kidnapped Bobby, insisted that practically all of the $600,000 ransom money was still in their possession. Hall admitted to planning the kidnapping, the actual abduction of the victim, and to burying the body in the yard of Bonnie Hetty's home, but he flatly denied having murdered the young boy. At first, Hall and Hetty blamed the murder of young Bobby on a man named Tom Marsh, claiming that the boy had still been alive when they'd handed him over. Yet when the FBI pointed out there was a number of inconsistencies with Hall's story, he admitted that he had fabricated the character of Tom Marsh and that he and Bonnie Hetty were solely to blame for Bobby's death. Hall told investigators that he and Hetty had driven Bobby to Overland Park, Kansas, after which they dragged him from the van, threw him to the ground, then shot him in the head. They then drove the boy's dead body back to St. Joseph, Missouri, where he buried it in Bonnie Hetty's yard and planted flowers on the grave. Bonnie Hetty admitted assisting Hall in the preparation of the ransom letters and notes of instructions to the Greenlease family concerning the payoff of the ransom, as well as going to the school and obtaining custody of the victim using the ruse that his mother was ill. Just before 9 a.m. on October 7th, Bobby's decomposing corpse was discovered by FBI agents, buried near the porch of the Hetty residence at 1201 South 38th Street in St. Joseph, Missouri. His tiny body had been wrapped in a large plastic sheet, and a huge quantity of lime had been poured over his corpse. Agents then located some .38-caliber shell casings, and a ballistic analysis determined that they had been fired from a .38-caliber snub-nosed revolver that had been found in Hall's possession at the time of his arrest. On October 30th, Carl Hall and Bonnie Hetty appeared before a federal judge in Kansas City, and both pled guilty to the murder of 6-year-old Bobby. After hearing the evidence for little over an hour, the federal judge recommended the death penalty and sentenced both of them to be executed on December 18th of 1953. "I think the verdict fits the evidence," the judge was quoted as saying. "It's the most cold-blooded, brutal murder I had ever tried." In the end, Carl Hall and Bonnie Heddy were executed together in the Missouri State Penitentiary's lethal gas chamber on December 18th of 1953. Carl was officially pronounced dead at 12:12 a.m., while Bonnie was declared deceased just 20 seconds later. To some, very few murders actually warrant a death penalty, and those that kill are often better left alive to stew in their guilt. Crimes of passion, accidental slayings, or even revenge killings prove that murder is not a black and white issue, and that there are many shades of gray in between. But those that kidnap a 6-year-old child, collect a ransom, but kill them anyway. Some might say that the gas chamber is far too humane a method of execution for people that are capable of such unspeakable evil. Back in the early 90s, Delaware-based lawyer Thomas J. Capano had a life that many of us might find enviable. He was a prominent and prosperous former state prosecutor with high-ranking political connections, and even ran a profitable home construction business during his spare time. He also had a large and loving family, consisting of a wife and 4 daughters. But by 1993, his marriage was falling into a downward spiral. Then right as his marital dissatisfaction was at its peak, he met a young, single woman by the name of Anne Marie Fahey. Fahey was employed as a congressional scheduling secretary, who had met Thomas Capano after meeting with Congressman Thomas Carper. Capano and Fahey began a romantic relationship shortly afterward, and as much as they tried to keep their affairs under wraps, it became known to an increasing number of friends and co-workers as the years dragged on. Fahey wasn't the only woman that Capano seemed to be having an affair with, but it seems that Fahey was his primary paramour for the following 3 years. From what I can gather, Capano treated Fahey gently and romantically at first, but as time went by, he grew more and more controlling, overbearing, and violently jealous. When Fahey attempted to end the relationship, Capano refused to allow her to leave him, and told her, if she even dared to try, he'd destroy her political career. So instead of risking another confrontation, Fahey reportedly began secretly dating other men, and went to great lengths to keep it a secret from Capano. The last known sighting of the couple was on June 27th of 1996, when they met for dinner to once again discuss their relationship. But after that, it was like Anne Fahey had simply dropped off the face of the earth. 2 days later, after becoming increasingly concerned for their daughter's safety, the Fahey family reported her missing. Not long after the missing persons report was filed, an agent with the FBI's Baltimore office heard about the case and offered his assistance to local authorities. Then, as the case progressed, various law enforcement agencies agreed to have the FBI take the lead on the investigation, owing to its vast resources and advanced capabilities. When the FBI learned of Fahey and Capano's affair, investigators quickly zeroed in on him as their number one suspect. When questioned by police, Thomas Capano claimed that he had invited Fahey to dinner over in Philadelphia, the goal of which was to resolve the problems in their relationship. He said the evening went well, that they'd come to an amiable agreement after a few hours of conversation, and that afterwards, he'd driven her back home before they parted on good terms. The FBI agents were almost sure that Capano was lying to them, but in order to prove it, the team was forced to use a number of creative investigative techniques to determine what had actually happened that night. This included surveillance, toll record analysis, seizure of emails from Capano's law firm and Fahey's office, analysis of gun purchase records, a 4-day search of 2 landfills, psychological profiling, and analysis of financial records. Finally, after a search of Anne Fahey's apartment, the investigation struck gold. Investigators found a number of handwritten letters addressed to Fahey from Capano, some written with an ominous and threatening tone. They also discovered Fahey's diary with numerous entries describing how Capano was a controlling, manipulative, insecure, jealous maniac. FBI agents then searched Capano's home and personal vehicle for traces of Fahey's blood and hair, and quickly found bloodstains on a metal radiator cover and some woodwork. The FBI then tracked down a blood bank which turned out to have a bag of Fahey's blood that she'd generously donated weeks earlier. This way, they were able to confirm that it was Fahey's blood in Capano's home and car. A blood bank search helped recover a container of blood that Fahey had donated weeks earlier, and forensic exams linked Fahey's blood to the blood found in Capano's house. As the investigation progressed, there was a kind of surprise twist. Capano's brother, Jerry, was arrested on various drug and weapons charges towards the end of 1997. In exchange for leniency, he admitted that he'd helped Thomas get rid of evidence which proved he'd murdered Fahey. According to Jerry, after Thomas Capano murdered his young lover, he forced her body into a large fishing cooler that he had purchased about 2 months earlier. Then on June 28th, Tom and Jerry Capano drove Jerry's boat some 70 miles off the New Jersey coast and dumped the cooler into the Atlantic Ocean. The cooler wouldn't sink, so Jerry shot it full of holes with a shotgun that he kept on board for shark fishing, but the cooler still wouldn't sink. Tom then lifted Fahey's body out of the cooler, wrapped two anchors around it, threw it overboard, and watched it sink. He then threw the cooler back into the water. The same cooler was later discovered by a group of fishermen who pulled it out from the ocean, plugged the bullet holes, and used it to hold the fish that they caught. The following year, after the story about the cooler made the news, one of the fishermen got in touch with the FBI and reported his find. The cooler then became a key piece of evidence which tied together Jerry's story. Finally, on November 12th of 1997, the FBI swooped in on Thomas Capano after they learned that he was planning to flee the country. During his trial in 1998, one of Tom Capano's ex-lovers told the court that just over a month before Anne Fahey's murder, Capano told her that if she purchased a pistol with her credit card, he'd purchase it from her for double the price she paid for it. With a mountain of damning evidence being turned against him, Capano completely changed his story. He claimed that the pistol-purchasing lover walked in on him and Fahey while they were being intimate, and had been so distraught by the sight that she actually threatened to take her own life with the gun she'd bought. Capano then claimed, as he tried to stop her, the gun went off by accident and killed Fahey. Capano said he then disposed of the body to protect himself and his lover. It made for a compelling story, but it was one the jury simply did not believe, and on January 17th of 1999, they pronounced him guilty for the murder of Anne Marie Fahey. Initially, Thomas Capano was sentenced to death for his crimes, but after a lengthy appeals process, his sentence was downgraded to life in prison without parole. Ironically, Capano later instituted his own death sentence in 2011 when his body was found hanging in his prison cell by prison officials. Efforts were made to revive him, but it was far too late. Capano was dead by his own hand. Anne Marie Fahey's body was never officially found, but we can assume that it's somewhere at the bottom of the Atlantic Ocean, not far from the New Jersey coastline. She might not have received a proper burial, but she certainly got the justice she deserved, as the man who took her life became so racked with pain, regret, and loneliness that he simply couldn't go on living anymore. On the morning of December 16th, 1989, an Alabama federal appeals judge named Robert Vance was greeted by a package when he walked out onto his porch. Given that it was the holidays, it wasn't entirely unusual for a gift or two to arrive, so Robert thought nothing of picking it up and bringing it inside his Mountain Brook home. Once inside, and having nothing suspicious about it, Judge Vance set about opening the package to see what was inside. Inside the small cardboard box was a smaller brown parcel, and when Judge Vance tore it open, a loud and devastating explosion ripped through his home, instantly killing him and seriously wounding his wife. The bombing caused a media firestorm, and local police rushed to begin work on what would no doubt be a long and high-profile investigation. Yet just as the investigation was commencing, yet another bombing put an Atlanta-based attorney named Robert Robertson in the hospital. Almost immediately after that, two more bomb scares occurred in Georgia and Florida. The first was intercepted while being transported to the federal courthouse in Atlanta, while the other was recovered after being mailed to the Jacksonville office of the NAACP. Further bloodshed was averted by the swift and valorous actions of bomb disposal experts in both states, but the defusal of the two bombs was a cold comfort to the general public, who were actually aware that more bombs might have been sent out in the mail. But what sick individual would be spiteful enough to send mail bombs during the holidays? Agents from the Federal Bureau of Investigation gathered the remnants of the bombs and packages and sent them off to various laboratories for analysis. Next, U.S. postal inspectors worked to learn the path the packages had taken through the postal system, which allowed the FBI to assemble a long list of potential suspects. As federal agents worked their way through the list of suspects, an ATF explosives expert was examining one of the unexploded bombs, only to notice something oddly familiar about its construction. When he reported it to his superior later that day, the explosives expert told them that he not only recognized the design of the bomb, but he could still remember the name of the man who built them that way. Walter Leroy Moody. With the prime suspect identified, the FBI set about surveillance of Walter Moody at home, and at one point, they were able to watch him even closer due to a brief stay in jail. It was during his time in jail that FBI agents discovered that Walter talked to himself, and the FBI realized that bugging his home might result in catching him talking about the bombings. Over the next year, extensive surveillance of Walter Moody revealed his motive for the bombings. The FBI found that Walter had a history of experimenting with explosives, with a conviction for bomb-making dating back to the 1970s. According to the trial, Moody had been constructing a bomb in his garage, one that had severely injured his wife when it accidentally exploded. Psychologists determined that Walter's conviction and failed appeals in that case had led him to harbor a long, festering resentment of the court system. So it came as no surprise when one of the judges on his unsuccessful appeals turned out to be none other than the first victim, Robert Vance. What's more, a surveillance agent had once noted that Moody frequently expressed racially bigoted opinions, which tied in with the NAACP being targeted with a bomb. It took just over a year to assemble enough evidence to secure a conviction, and in the summer of 1991, Walter was put on trial for the bombings. The trial was tough, to say the least, and it was a chilling testament to Moody's intelligence that he'd taken every effort to conceal his connection to the bombings. However, on June 28th of 1991, based on the extensive investigative work of numerous law enforcement agencies, the jury found Walter Moody guilty of more than 70 charges, including murder and attempted murder. In 2018, after once again failing numerous appeals, Walter was finally executed following a last meal of Philly cheesesteaks, Dr. Pepper, and M&M's. It marked the end of a brutal and vengeful man who abused the trust Americans have in their postal service to mail violent death to those that have wronged him. Hey friends, thanks for listening. Click that notification bell to be alerted of all future narrations. I release new videos every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And if you got a story, be sure to submit them to my subreddit, r/letsreadofficial, and maybe even hear your story featured on the next video. And if you want to support me even more, grab early access to all future narrations and bonus content over on Patreon. Or click that big join button to learn about the extra perks offered for the channel. And check out the Let's Read podcast, where you can hear all of these stories in big compilations and save huge on data, located anywhere you listen to podcasts. Links in the description below. Thanks so much, friends. And remember to always microwave your M&M's.